On our tape today, we are going to make a study together with the Zohar of John. In our study of how the Jews interpret the Bible, we saw that there were four distinctive levels of interpretation. The first level was the Mishneh level and the application of the seven laws of Rabbi Hillel the Great. The second level of interpretation was the Gemoric level, or the Gemorah, in application of the 13 laws of Rabbi Ishmael. The third level of interpretation, the Midrashic level, is the application of the 32 laws of Rabbi Eleazar ben Galil. Then the fourth level of interpretation was the Zohar, or the application of the 42 laws of the Kabbalah. The Kabbalists, those who receive the secret interpretation of the Torah, are those who produce the Zohar, or the radiance of the interpretation. Today our devotions will be comparable to that. In the first level of interpretation, the Mishnah of Mark, we saw in the Talit and the Tzitzit that Jesus wore a detailed analysis from the Midrash on the two primary subjects of the Talit and the issue of blood. In this particular tape, we would like to devote our, in the next tape, we devoted our attention to the Gemara of Luke, the allegorical application of the riddle of the Messiah. In the Midrashic level of interpretation, tape number 8106, we saw the Midrash of Matthew, and we dealt in the parabolic application of the riddle of the rejected king, or the rejected kingdom. And today we are going to study in this level, the Zohar of John, in the aspect of the title of the Echoes from Eden. The Echoes from Eden. In the definition of the Jewish Kabbalist, the Kabbal, Lekabel, means to receive. The Kabbalah are those who receive the heavenly, the divine, the otherworldly interpretation, the mystical interpretation of the Torah. Unlike Christian mysticism and secular mysticism, the mystic in Judaism is subject to the and limited by the words of Torah. And his interpretation has to be built on the foundation of the Torah and the pillars of the Mishnah and the beams of the Gemara and the portico of the Midrash, so that the Zohar is like a roof on the building of the interpretation in its fullest sense. It is a housetop, if we might call it, those that dwell under the stars. The Kabbalist in Judaism is defined thusly: the darkest hour of the night is the hour before the dawn. He that stands in the twilight can see the winged feathered fingers of the sun pushing away the darkness of the night. Hayelet Ishachar, the sun of the morning. As the sun begins to rise, the aura, the radiance of the beams of light coming over the horizon, stretching like fingers, like horns of light, pushing back the darkness and announcing the coming of the day. However, once the sun has arisen, there is no more aura. When the sun becomes visible, the beautiful winged feathered fingers are drawn into the sun and folded away. Like an eagle in flight, he soars, but once he has come to rest, his wings become invisible. So is the Zohar. The radiance, the beams of light that go out. The word Zohar actually means the radiance, the aura of the Torah. And those that interpret the aura of the Torah are not interested in the words, the narratives per se. They're not so interested in even the letters as they are the forms between the letters. It is said that when the Messiah comes, he will interpret the space between the letters. While we look at letters and we form images by the dark print on the white paper or parchment, the Kabbalist looks at it as though the letters are horns of light, and the darkness behind it has a message, because he who created the light and formed the darkness, the darkness was here already, but with the speaking of the universe into existence, those tongues of fire, as it were, be speaking and uttering as they pass through space, the creation into existence by the word of his mouth. We see that the Kabbalists are interested in the space between the letters. Sometimes we call it reading between the lines. But there is an aura of the Torah that is separate from the object of the Torah itself. There is a radiance which is above the mere print on the page. And in order to see that, one must stand in the twilight. The Apostle John was such a one. Living on the Sea of Galilee, no place on earth could give greater occasion to the birth of a Kabbalist than to see the sunrise over the Golan Heights and the aura as it is reflected in the Sea of Galilee. Just a few miles up the hill, a city called Safat has been a Kabbalistic center throughout the centuries because of the aura, the natural aura that fills the heavens with ever rising and every setting of the sun. There is here, in this atmosphere, where John, the son of Zebedee, had spent his whole life fishing, that one could not help but be a mystic. The mystic is again described as two men who stood behind bars. One saw the mud, the other the stars. It depends on which way one looks. John was one whose eyes were turned heavenly. He saw the otherworldness. He saw the mystical. He read between the lines. and sometimes even putting ropes of things between the lines. Those who have their eyes on the mud don't see the stars. Today, I want to take you into what some people would call the tragedy of the New Testament, the crucifixion story of Jesus. And I want us to look at John's account and see how he's trying to convey to us a certain something that is unique in its own presentation. It seems that John sees through the masses of the crowds and the common people and the aristocracy that was bringing all this about, and the majestic level of the Roman and Pontius Pilate and all this. He sees through all of that, and he sees a certain something that others had not seen. I want us to try to share it together. In the book of John, chapter 18 and chapter 19, what some would consider the tragedy, the passion of Jesus, and to see in that something more than what appears on the mere surface. In the Zohar, it is written somewhere in each of us, there is an Adam. In exile from the garden, in need of restoration. The work of the Kabbalah is to restore man to his primo state. We are the workmen, and we are the laboratory of this sphere of restoration. If one can but attach the fiber of his soul to that thread that dangles loosely from the 10 heavenly spheres, he has begun the work of this restoration. If one can find the secret opening at the base of the skull, he had found the entrance to this restoration. John was that mystic who drew pictures from the past on the canvas of the present. John was the mystic who had that transcendentalist faith, which is the eye of the soul that can behold things that are not seen with the natural eyes. Those are the ears of faith. He that hath ears to hear, let him hear what he said. This is that seeing, this is that hearing, this is that feeling that goes beyond the sense of natural touch and ordinary feeling. This is that inner part of man, the inner soul, that reaches through the invisible darkness to touch the unseen. John describes the account of Jesus before Pontius Pilate, the Roman governor, somewhat differently than the other accounts. The reason his account is different from the others is not that the others are wrong or he is right, or he is wrong and they are right, but as the Kabbalist, he's trying to reach in beyond what he's seen. And we see in that story, beginning with the 28th verse of the 18th chapter, that Jesus was led from the house of Caiaphas, the high priest who had been appointed by the Roman government, not a true high priest of Israel, no, but one of the stooge priests that was appointed by the Roman government. He was one who John and the other disciples had hoped to see overthrown when their master set up his kingdom. This Caiaphas, the illegitimate priest, and he was brought from the house of Caiaphas to Pilate. Pilatus, the Roman governor. And in the inquisition that Pontius Pilatus made in Jesus, when they entered the judgment hall, he called unto Jesus, not in low tones, but he called out in a commanding voice, "Are you the King of the Jews?" The arrogancy of this little Jew from Galilee, as he stood before the man who had power to destroy him or to give him life, and the chutzpah, the defendant, becomes the inquestor. As Jesus says, "Sayest thou this of thyself, or did others tell it of me?" What Jesus is doing is putting Pilate in the seat of the witness rather than the seat of the judge. And it is Jesus who takes the role of the judge and questions the judge about the source of his information. Is this first hand, or is this hearsay? Are you asking me for yourself, or because someone else said? Even in Roman law, hearsay was not admissible. But to think that the chutzpah of this little Jew to challenge the question that Pontius Pilate would ask him. Pilate said, "Am I a Jew? Am I a Jew? Thine own nation and the chief priests have delivered thee unto me. What hast thou done? What is the charge?" Jesus answered and said, My kingdom is not of this age. If my kingdom were of this age, then would my servants fight that I should not be delivered to these Judeans? But now my kingdom is not from hence. As he stretched his hands around that kingdom of Judea, he says, My kingdom has nothing to do with this. Huh. The potentate caught here a snare. And he walks close to Jesus and looks him in the eye and says, Then, art thou king? Jesus answered and said, You're talking. Thou sayest, That ain't so much to say, what are you trying to do, Talitha? Crown me as king yourself? Are you trying to make me a king? Ah, what an insult to Pilate. Who is this? What a whisper, what audacity that he would say such to me. Before Pilate could finish his thought, Jesus said a very startling thing. To this end was I born, and for this cause came I into the world. Wait a minute. Wait. What is this end? What is this cause? Don't you know that you are standing before a man that can put you on the cross at one word, and you're having the, what is the cause and what is the end? But before Pilate could collect that thought, he said that I should bear witness of the truth, and everyone that is of the truth hears my voice. Pontius Pilate, the Roman governor, was schooled in all the Grecian to bear witness of the truth. To this, Pontius Pilate turned and looked at that mob outside, and he turned and looked at the rabbi standing in his customary attire with his talit, with his yarmulke. What good? What harm did this man do? This man is a teacher. He's a prophet. Certainly, he can do no harm. Perhaps I will do more to destroy him than I will to let him go. What justice would there be? Pilate dropped his head, having thought on all he had learned about the pursuit of truth, and almost under his breath, he said, What is truth? Suddenly, Pilate moves into the shore of the mystic. He begins to question himself and ask questions inside himself. Then, remembering his responsibility, he drew up his shoulders and walked back to the crowd outside. And he said unto them, I find no fault in him at all. But because you have a custom that I should release unto you one at the Passover, will you therefore that I release unto you the King of the Jews? And they all cried again, saying, Not this man, but Barabbas. Barabbas was a robber. 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 I hear an echo in the words of John that resound through the ages, resound through all the Jewish law, resound all the way back to the Garden of Eden. Because according to the rabbis, the original sin, the original sin of man was none other than robbery. God had given Adam a title deed to the entire world. Everything on earth and in the earth and in the sea was in a title deed to Adam and to Eve. The only exception to this inheritance was one little piece of chattel, a tree of knowledge of good and evil. All the trees of the world were Adam's, but one tree, in the midst of the garden was not an Adam's deed to the whole world. There was only one thing in the whole world that Adam and Eve could take that was not theirs, and that was the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil. Every other tree was theirs, but this tree was forbidden to them. And when Eve reached out and put her hand on that fruit and pulled that fruit off that tree, it was the only thing in God's earth that she could have stolen or robbed God of. Everything else belonged to her. The transgression of every sin begins at the threshold of robbery. One must break down the fence of robbery to enter into the transgression of any commandment of God. If one commits murder, what has he really done? He has robbed another of the days of his life, not only of living, not only robbing him of his own joys of life, but his posterity. When Cain killed Abel, he robbed Abel of the days of his life, but not only Abel did he rob, he robbed all of the heirs of Abel, his children who were never born, and his descendants who never came to be, because Cain robbed Abel of life. Robbery is the threshold to murder. Thou shalt not commit adultery. What is adultery? That is robbing someone of affection and pleasure that belongs to them and does not belong to you or to me. That is the difference between lust and love. Love creates, lust destroys. And the first threshold that one must cross is a threshold of robbery, robbing affection from someone else to give affection to yourself. Taking self and making it enthroned to feast on the table that belongs to another. That is robbery. Here, in this chapter, we see Jesus took the place of a robber because in order to answer to the real issue in every transgression, he must take the place of a robber. He had to reach back to Eden and reach back and touch the fruit of robbery. And he did that by accepting the place of Barabbas. For this cause came I into the world. To this end was I born. Pontius Pilate thought, if they see blood, they'll be satisfied. And he ordered a Roman soldier to come who was skilled in the art. And in the first chapter of the 19th verse of the 19th chapter, it says that Pilate therefore took Jesus and scourged him, tying his hands above him. The Roman soldier who was skilled with the cat of nine tails. He was not equipped with an ordinary rope because the cat of nine tails had barbs in the end of the hip, the leash. And he very gently got this in motion and very skillfully wound it about his head and laid it in precisely at the right place, not hard, very softly, but the instant that the leashes came in contact with the back, the man who was scourging was jerked and it would literally plow out the tissues, the sinews, and the veins. And there would be a profuse bleed. And then he would go very gently, winding the scourge, swinging it so gently till he got the rhythm. And then he would take it over his head and again bring it around and very carefully lay it just above the previous incision and leash again and plow out the sinews and the tissues, the veins. Blood gushed again. And certainly Pilate thought, when they see blood, they'll be satisfied and they'll let him go. It's hard to imagine one being merciful by scourging, but Pilate was hoping that maybe this is all it would take, and then again the scourge was laid in 39 times, line on line and row on row and furrow on furrow. It went up his back. It seemed like a mere happened chance that Pilate would even come up with such an idea that scourging would satisfy this bloodthirsty mob. Here there is an echo that goes all the way back to the Garden of Eden. In the book of Psalms, chapter 129, and verse 3, the psalmist foresaw and shared the same feeling, perhaps by his own experience, but it bespoke of a later experience. Many times they have afflicted me from my youth, yet they have not prevailed against me. And then in verse 3, the plowers have plowed my back. They made long their furrows. If we read the context of the 129th Psalm, the primary interpretation of that has to do with the suffering of Israel at the hands of the Gentiles. And we don't want to take away from that at all today, because there are still those that hate Zion, and Israel is still suffering, just like described in this verse. But the account of this Pontius Pilate's order for the scourging of Jesus seemed to wrap up historically the scourging of his nation. The plowers have plowed my back. They made long their furrows. And as the scourge cut its way through, one leech on another, one row on another, one furrow on another, it looked as though his back had been peeled by a plow. What does this mean? Beyond David, we can look all the way back to the Garden of Eden. And there, in the book of Genesis, chapter 4, and verse 2, when he's talking about Cain and Abel, Abel was a keeper of the sheep. Cain was a tiller of the ground. In the third chapter of Genesis, in the 17th verse, just before the birth of Cain and Abel, God Almighty had said, "Cursed be the ground for thy sake. Cursed be the ground for thy sake." And here, Cain was a tiller of the ground, was a tiller of the ground. There was a curse put upon the ground. And Cain, the cursed one, was a tiller of the ground. The ground is groaning under curse since Adam's damning day. Toiled and tilled, with blood spilled, seems Abel's echoed voice to say, "Damn, damn, damn this ground, to bear its curse away. The earth, the ground, is cursed, and the hope Israel in their messianic expectation is that when the Messiah comes, he will redeem the ground, the earth. Paul said the whole creation is growing and travailing and pining together till now, awaiting the redemption, to wit, the resurrection of the body. Thy brother's blood crieth unto me. I, said God, now where is thy brother? The word I is an exclamation. When man and woman sin, he didn't say, where art thou, Adam? He said, I, Adam. Exclamation. When Cain slew Abel, he did not say, where is Abel thy brother? He said, I, Abel thy brother's blood is crying to me from the ground. That Roman soldier thought it a routine thing that day to step up with that scourge at the command of his governor, Pontius Pilate, and scourge the back of this Jew. What did he carry? Another Jew? Another scourge. A routine thing. For Jews to be scourged by the Romans, it was nothing unusual. Wasn't the first time Paul had been, even Paul was scourged later. But what do we see here? His back was plowed. And as he was loosened after the cat of nine tails had plowed 39 furrows up his back, he was set down and mocked as a king. The Roman soldiers were going to make a big joke out of this, and they put on him a purple robe. A mock king. But what is a king with a robe? It's not a crown. They looked around, and growing out of one of the walls, it is not uncommon in the Middle East, was a thorn vine. It's called the nachash, the serpent vine. Because if it sticks you, it's like you've been bitten by a serpent. You swell, and it's inflamed, and it's very painful. And the swelling is as though one had been bitten by an asp. The Roman soldier went over with his sword and clipped it off. Very carefully took the long prongs and walked over to Jesus. They didn't plait it and put it on his head. They plaited three of these together. And then he walked over with these thorns sticking in every direction. A long rope of a thorn vine plaited together. And they simply took it and wrapped it cruelly, binding it sadistically about his head so that the thorns pierced into his brow. Why was that necessary? What's all this sadistic treatment these base Roman soldiers seem to be enjoying the show so much? And they probably were sadists. Maybe God put a sadist in that situation to be sadistic. In binding those thorns to his brow, pain that you cannot imagine, and swelling until the eyes were swollen and the face was swollen and the brow was swollen and even the neck began to be deformed. in Isaiah, the 52nd chapter, in verse 14, as many as were astounded at thee, his visage is so marred, more than any man, and his form more than the sons of man. I hear an echo in the song, resounding all the way back to the Garden of Eden. His face was more marred than any man, and his form, his bodily form, more than the sons of men. So that when Pilate saw him after the scourging and the crowning, he said, Ecce homo, is this the man? Is this the man? He was mutilated beyond recognition. Why? I hear an echo all the way back to the Garden of Eden when the ground was cursed. In the 17th verse of the 3rd chapter of Genesis, the next verse reads, thorns also and thistles shall it bring forth to thee. Thorns and thistles will it bring forth unto thee. So this echo all the way back to Eden was more than the mere happenstance and circumstances that surrounded the situation. John is trying to reach back, and as a Kabbalist, he's trying to get us to see the transcendental, the mystical, the otherworldliness, the eternal purpose. For this, to this end was I born, and for this cause came I into the world. He's echoing in the ears of Pontius Pilate, and whose echo has been indelibly imprinted upon the ears and minds of men since the story was recorded by John the mystic. And then the story goes on, and we find that Jesus was given again and again the opportunity to step out of this mad theater where the gladiator was facing with the mob. It seemed so very easy, but he didn't deter from going all the way. And then Pilate said to him, from whence art thou? And Jesus gave him no answer. Then Pilate said unto him, speakest thou not unto me, knowest that I have the power to crucify thee or the power to release thee? The arrogant little Jews, stood there and looked at this Roman straight in the eye and said, "You have no power at all against me, except it were given thee from above. Therefore he that delivered me unto thee hath the greater sin." Wait a minute. Who was that? Judas? No. The high priest? No. There is an echo all the way back to Eden. There was a destiny that had delivered him to Pilate. "For this cause, to this end was I born, and for this cause came I into the world." From this point, Pilate saw how to release him. But the Judeans were crying out, "If you let this man go, you're not Caesar's friend. You're not Caesar's friend if you let him go." Oh, what a raging assault upon the Roman governor. When Pilate therefore heard the saying, he brought Jesus forth and set him down in the judgment seat at a place which is called in the Hebrew Gabbatha, Gabbatha. This was that Acra. This was that hill that until the Hasmoneans cut it down stood taller than the temple area just to the north side of the temple. Gabbatha, the hill, Gabbatha, the hill where Solomon's palace stood. Now stood the fortress of Antonio. And Pilate sat there in judgment. And in disgust, Pontius Pilate weighed the situation. What is the life of this Jew against my career as the governor? If I let him go and Caesar learns and he does make an insurrection, I'm dead. What does it matter if there's one more Jew executed? But I will pin it on them. Pilate walks forth, and in the dilemma of the moment, he asked them, "Shall I crucify your king?" And they reply, the biggest lie in Jewish history, "We have no king but Caesar." That shows what this crowd was. And that's why the Talmud speaks of this evil generation that preceded the destruction of the temple. And that's why the Sanhedrin was called a destructive Sanhedrin. And that's why the Jewish Talmud says that they brought the wrath of God on the house of Israel, the stooges of Herod and the Romans, who because of the vanity of their political office were threatened by this one, the Jewish Talmud said, they brought the destruction. When they said, "We have no king but Caesar," it was blasphemy against everything that traditional Judaism stood for and believed, because Israel has no king but Torah. "Then delivered he therefore unto them and said, Here is your king." You see, by saying this, it exonerated Pilate. He had washed his hands. He had washed his hands of the blood of this innocent man. But he said, you're going to be responsible. And when the Jew said, let his blood be on us, and John didn't even mention this, but when the Jews said to Pontius Pilate, let his blood be on us and on our children, they're saying, we're taking responsibility with Caesar. You're not crucifying an innocent man. We are responsible. He said, then he's your king. Pontius Pilate. In the crisis of a moment, delivered him to be crucified. But there's something very strange. As he said, that he went, that bearing his cross, he went forth to a place called the place of the skull, which is called in Hebrew Golgoth, or Golgotha. Being taken to this hill, Golgoth, the place of the skull. Just outside the horse gate, or the gate of Ephraim, across the moat that the Hasmoneans had cut to separate that area that the Babylonians had bridged over in the destruction of the tower that standeth out, the grotto of Jeremiah, and
the remainder of this message is continued on the Zohar of John, Part 2. Please take this tape out and put in Part 2.